Welcome to the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe podcast. My name is Mike Quackenbush. I'm joined by Clayton Morris, and today I'm going to tell you how much I hate fake holidays like Labor Day. Labor Day, Memorial Day, Flag Day, Columbus Day, President's Day, and anything along these lines need to be canceled.
But you do love Halloween.
So but no one gets off for Halloween. Banks are open on Halloween.
And see,
Post office open. All vendors aren't like, our offices are closed.
I wish we got off for Halloween. That seems like an appropriate holiday to get off, right? You have to prepare. You have to go and find some time to buy some kids some Halloween outfits. You have to go and find the perfect costume yourself. You've got to go out and trick-or-treat. You've got to buy candy. There's a lot of prep that goes into Halloween.
Maybe the day after. Like, after I've eaten all the candy, I'd want off. Like, I want to lay around.
That's called Fat Tuesday.
It should be.
I know. You really can't stand the holidays when you cannot get anything done at the post office.
Just in general. Like, everyone's like, oh, yeah, we're not open on Labor Day or whatever. Like, these are not real holidays.
Right.
Like, let's be honest about what, you know, as I often say over on another podcast where I appear, Daddy on Board. You know, the world is America, right? We own the world.
Mm-hmm.
There are some countries that think we don't own them. We're buying them right now.
And we know we have a lot of UK listeners, Australia, as well as Canada listeners to this show. We apologize, but we do own. I think we own Australia now, don't we?
Right. Like, you're like the 53rd state.
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe you're just a territory like Guam or Puerto Rico. I don't know. But, We need to – we here in the United States, which is kind of like the headquarters of America, the U.S., we are lazy. We are really lazy people. And because of that, I think the counterbalance must be we just need fewer holidays because not enough work is getting done. Like, if I get one more auto response, our offices are closed for the Labor Day holiday. Like, I'm going to put my fist through my monitor screen.
I actually saw, and I didn't even know this was possible, but I actually saw a software company. I was online using some software, and it said, hey, you know, our customer support will be down for Labor Day. I'm mm-hmm. thinking, don't you guys farm that out to India anyway?
Right! Seriously! Like, you know what? Our buddy Ashok didn't take yesterday off.
Right.
Like,
he's working. India doesn't shut down.
No, and God bless you, Ashok. Let me tell you something. The real hardworking people of the universe, they deserve some real thanks, right? Ashok and his team over there, Nipur, you're doing a great job. Don't ever become so Americanized, as outstanding as your English is. Don't ever become so Americanized that you take Labor Day off.
But aren't there like a ton of Jewish holidays for which you'll get like a week and a half off here and there?
Me? Well, not you.
I mean, I know you're not Jewish, but there are...
Right.
I know that there are quite a few, like, sort of Middle Eastern holidays, at least, that seem like they're weeks in length, mm-hmm. and, like, nothing gets done during them.
I don't know. I haven't come across that yet.
Boy, man, whatever you do, just don't move to the Middle East, because then you'll never get anything sent from the post office.
Right. Let me tell you, there'll be two chief reasons not to go to the Middle East. One, those week-long festival-type holidays. Two, it's the Middle East.
Right.
It's super dangerous. I think the weather's awful, and the food is not all that good. You ever go to one of those Middle Eastern restaurants? Like, half of it's yuck.
It depends. I will give you that. I've had some kebabs that I thought should have been lining the street. However...
In what way? Like, to make traffic go a certain way?
You know, like pebbles. Yeah.
Like how are we going to get the horses to go down there, get the kebabs?
Get the kebabs, lay them out there. Lay them out there. We need some gravel. You ran out of gravel? Grab some kebabs.
Let me ask you this. I know you may not want to talk about this on the air, but we're going to anyway. You travel.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to do some travel upcoming.
Right.
There are places I would love to travel to. Tell me somewhere you would never want to go. I'm putting it out there. The Middle East.
Hmm. Yeah, I really don't have a desire to go to one of these really oppressive Middle Eastern countries, right?
Nope. Like, I don't need it.
We were sort of joking, my wife and I, the other day. She said, you know, Saudi Arabia, the women still aren't allowed to drive. And I said, Right. Maybe they're on to something. She didn't find that all that funny. But,
no, I liked it.
Yeah, you did. No, you know, I think you're right. Some of those countries where it's you're worried about the oppression. Just, you know.
Well, I'm not worried about being oppressed. I just think it'll be all around awful.
Right, but I mean, just where you have to worry about every little thing as you're making your way down into the public square. You know, am I allowed to carry this smartphone with me for fear of like government reprisal? I could probably like Iran. That would probably be right. Worst on my list. Now, I will not say that about North Korea, because to me that would be a fascinating case study. I mean,
and you know that all the North Koreans listen to this podcast,
right? I mean, like, we're very popular in North Korea,
right? If you heel turn on them, look out, because there's going to be trouble. There's a lot of nutbags up there in North Korea.
Kim Jong-un had admitted that one of his favorite shows was American Idol. His favorite podcast was the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe.
That shocked me.
It really did.
His English is choppy at best.
Right.
So I was really surprised. You know what? I'll say this. One place I would never want to go is like anywhere in Africa where the nation is predominantly desert.
So all of Africa.
Oh, well, except not all of Africa is that, right?
Congo. Congo.
That's probably a perfect example, the Congo. I don't need to go there. I'd like to go to Morocco. Like Morocco
would be nice.
Right.
But see, yeah, Congo's not really
Bondy kind of moment there.
Congo's not really desert though, right? It's very very humid, isn't it? And very jungle-like in the Congo.
Right. Yeah, I don't need to go there. You know what I know about the Congo really? I know a little bit from a movie and the rest from that latter period Genesis song.
That's about all good. I know. In addition to Americans being lazy, we're uninformed.
Mm-hmm. Hang on a second. I take offense to that. Let me Wikipedia Congo.
Also, The Heart of Darkness. Isn't that the Joseph Conrad book, The Heart of Darkness, which is sort of the premise for Apocalypse Now, the film from the
67. That's crazy. I had Apocalypse Now in the brain this morning. Yeah, I never want to go there, or here's the other place I never want to go. Anywhere I'm going to need kidnap insurance for myself.
See, I would think you would have a difficult time in Asia because, you know, you have such an aversion to seafood and those types of food. I know when you did your Japanese tour,
right?
You just brought a whole bunch of power bars, right?
You're right. I sure did. Yeah, I ran out of them on day three. I was blasting through them.
It seems to me kind of a shame. I mean, you know, I love you to death. You're my best friend, even if you are a curmudgeon world traveler. I have to say it would be a shame. Because I think one of the real beauties of the world is in experiencing the foods of the world as well. You know, getting to indulge in the culture. I think a lot of culture comes through food. Mm-hmm. And I have to see, like, I wonder what it would be like to travel like you. Because for me, when I go to France, oh man, all I want to do is, you know, have like a incredible like cafe au lait or whatever, and like a croissant, you know, and eat the chocolate pastry. Of course, I guess that's what you do too. But
right, I was going to say, well, I don't see where we're diverging on this path here. But like, let me get my bags.
But then for dinner, you actually need to eat like some actual proteins, and you know, have like an incredible duck breast dinner at a little French restaurant. To me, is, you know, it's like my wife's favorite meal she's ever had. You know, and so but. I have to imagine that might be a little hard for you. You'd probably say to me, Clayton, go ahead. You're going to go to have the duck breast. I'm going to go back and get another chocolate pastry.
I might. Yeah. Well, as I think you know, my dish of choice everywhere I've ever gone in Europe is spaghetti bolognese.
And actually, you're probably pretty lucky because it's not just Italy that has great Italian food. Even in Germany, when we were there, they had great Italian food. So, and I even, you know, you can get great bolognese just about all over Europe.
Sure. And there's little bits of variation. Like a bolognese that you might get in Germany is not exactly the same as the one you might get in Holland or the one you might get in Austria. So I do like that. There are other things that I do eat over there, but that's like my go-to because it's fairly safe. And I think part of my reluctance is, as it relates to that, as you know, I have a very limited palate, is that I would pay money and wait for a meal to be delivered to me, and I would take one bite and I would hate it. And then I have that, like, all right, I'm in another country. Like, am I going to try and send this back? Are we going to have an argument about whether or not I'm paying for it? Like, right. How do we even begin to go about all of that? And so, well, to an extent, I could probably experiment beyond what I do. It's simply easier. It's simply more convenient to go with – because I'll tell you what. In all the countries I've gone to, all the places I've traveled, I've only ever had one bad bowl of spaghetti bolognese.
Like, really? Would you remember the country? Because I'll make sure I don't go to that country because of the bolognese.
It might have been in the southern part of Germany where it seemed to have been made more like with carrots.
Yeah, well, you know, that's funny you say that, because, you know, I'm a big bolognese fan as well. And I actually make it's sort of, I guess, known in Italian circles as the Sunday sauce, you know, that they sort of make all day.
I didn't know that was an Italian expression.
Yeah, it's sort of the Sunday sauce, or the Sunday gravy, as they call it. Sunday gravy, which is not gravy at all. It's like a bolognese.
Right.
You know, different variations thereof that are made by Italian families around the world, or around, you know, whatever. So on a Sunday. But anyway, one of my favorite recipes that I've come across that I actually save, I make it on a regular basis, and my wife sort of gets excited about it when I'm going to make my bolognese sauce. And so sometime you're going to have to try this when you're over, because I make it and I let it simmer all day long on a Sunday.
Mm.
And part of the recipe is, you know, and I can vary it up for you, but is carrots.
Sure.
Just a little bit of carrots, just finely
chopped.
Right,
just a little bit. That's the trick. Like, it shouldn't have an overwhelming carrot taste.
Right, you almost shouldn't even see it. It almost looks like it blends into the sauce, and it should be finely chopped, like using a food processor, like almost like granular, you know?
Yes, I agree with that. But I've had one where it was like a carrot paste on top of my pasta.
Yeah, you know, you get these different variations. The type of bolognese I'm not a fan of has to be, and I know that a lot of Italians like this, but I'm not a fan of it. That, like, the, it's a very soupy sauce, and it has like just big chunks of like sweet sausage in it.
Mm, yeah, I know what you're talking
about. You know what I'm saying? Like, and people will call that bolognese as well. And
sure,
it might have like big chopped mushrooms in it and big chopped sausage chunks. And maybe a few little meatball chunks, but that's about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
The bolognese I like is like almost like it's kind of, you know, it's much thicker, and it's not like soupy like you get spaghetti and meatball style, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I agree. And don't get me wrong, you know, I enjoy on occasion trying other things, but I think for those reasons, like I said, like if it's bad, you know, it's just not what I want, and then now I'm the ugly American because I'm not eating what you served me and all that. It just doesn't seem worth it.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem worth it to try. I guess, you know, if I get hot on the Powerball or something and I just had money to burn,
yeah,
I would probably be a far more experimental eater when I travel. But
yeah.
But you're right. Like, when I went to Japan, or I would imagine if I traveled to other places where seafood is more predominant, I'd stock up. You know, like I'd go with a bag full of Power Bars and stuff. But you got to be careful. Like, some countries, they'll limit the amount of stuff you can bring in, and then you pay a tariff to bring them into the country. Like, if they feel
really?
Like the amount that you have
like
on
you're going to sell them. Like, this guy's got 1,000 Power Bars. He's here for a week. That can't be his own. He's trying to sell these things.
Exactly, yeah. If they feel like it's more than what your personal usage would be. And if you get hit with that anything, that you're bringing what would be a commercial good for resale in, the fees that you pay are outrageous. I know this from whether it's taking, like, T-shirts with me or things like that. Even if I say, hey, look, you know, I'm bringing all of these along to give to gifts or give as gifts to the, you know, to the people that I'm working for or things like that, they'll say, well, you know, there's just no way that we can justify you bringing 18 additional T-shirts into this country. So you're going to pay $6 on every one that you're bringing in, or €6 or whatever it is. And the same thing, like, you know, you really, you know, and, you know, it's kind of a no nonsense thing when they pull you aside at the airport into their little cubicle and they're like, why do you have 32 Power Bars in your bag? Like, well, you got to figure, right? One for breakfast, one for lunch, maybe a snack, two for dinner. You know, I'm here for 7 days. A couple, you know, buffer ones in case.
I don't like sushi. I can't have any. And I can only eat so much Pocky. So you better figure out something for me.
Now, there are so many flavors of Pocky, though. Like, really, I'm...
Right. I get excited. I was a little nervous. I thought, well, maybe I wouldn't like German food. You know, that might, maybe there would just be a lot of schnitzel, or not schnitzel. There might just be a lot of like bratwurst or something. You know, like I'm just going to be eating meat all week. And my wife and I went there a few years ago, and boy, was it delicious. And as my wife talks about, she said, some of the best food I've ever had. And it seems like this is the type of food that would be up your alley, right? Like a big, just like side of like delicious mashed potatoes kind of thing, with like some schnitzel, which is just like, I think it's just like dough that's like fried or mm-hmm. like, you know, deep fried or something. And I forget what exactly it is. Then you get meat, you know, you get whatever meat might be chopped up. You can get that mixed in, and it's just, oh, it's fantastic. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like the meat and potatoes type of culture there.
Right. When I was in, you know, of course, Wiener Schnitzel comes from Vienna.
Yes, that's right.
So when I was in Vienna, of course, I had to have it, and I liked it. And, you know, I guess I think it was when I was in the Netherlands. It kind of became a gag this past summer because of the Avengers movie. But a few years ago, I had shawarma when I was there, and I was surprised how much I liked that.
Yes, and we went to Stuttgart on our way back to fly out of Frankfurt, and that day we stopped in Stuttgart for lunch, and it's a there's a very large population that, you know, eat shawarma on a very regular basis. And so we went to this little shawarma place for lunch, and it was delicious. Mm-hmm. We got to get more of this, you know. So I'm going to try to have some of that when I go back there. But yeah, I'm excited about the food there. And, you know, it's interesting the amount of love and sort of, I mean, you know, the, I guess the sort of focus and love that you, everything that you do with what you do with Chikara, you know. Mm-hmm. We had dinner the other night at for my wife's birthday. Do you ever watch Top Chef Masters on Bravo?
No, I know what it is, though.
Season 5 is now on, and I think it's by far and away my wife's favorite show. But season 4, the winner was Floyd Cardoz, and he is, I think he's from India originally.
His name is Floyd?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure if he grew up there. I don't know his whole history exactly, because you would think that his restaurant then would be just Indian food, right? But it's not at all. Like, in fact, I don't think there's anything on the menu that's of Indian origin. But his restaurant in Manhattan, so I took her there for her birthday and surprised her. You know, she didn't know whose restaurant we were going to, had no idea. And then he came over the table and was, you know, I had met him before, and we're friends, and he's just an incredibly gracious guy. But he has such a love of food. And he has such a love of the, you know, the derivation of recipes, where these things came from. So on his menu, and I was blown away by this, I got, and I had to order this, a clam and oyster stew. May have been the best bowl of soup I've ever had. It was incredible, and the spice in it. And I told him that this was incredible, and he said, you know that recipe? I had read a book about New York and how it was called The Big Oyster. And I said, I read that book last year as well, about how New York City used to be the place in the world for oysters. But then they polluted the Hudson so badly with industrialization and everything, just wiped out all the oyster beds. And he said this recipe was from the 1600s. And his restaurant sat right where those oyster beds were. Like, you could literally take something from his restaurant and chuck it across the street and it would go right into the Hudson. That's how close it was to the river. And these oyster beds, in fact, the street is like lined with old oyster shells right by his restaurant. And I knew this from having read the book, and I didn't realize it was the same spot. But the recipe is in this book from the 1600s, and he took that recipe and made it today. It's amazing to me that, like, you know, food can be just like transcend generations in that way, that you're having this bowl of oyster and clam stew, and it tastes perhaps the exact same as it did 300 years ago. I never thought of food that way before, and it was a sort of a revelatory evening at Floyd's restaurant. So anyway, if you ever get to Manhattan, anybody, and you're interested in going to a great restaurant, and it's not ridiculously expensive at all, it's a great restaurant called the North End Grill down near the Financial District in Tribeca. Ooh, man, was it good. Man, was it good. Thank you, Floyd. Hmm.
Did you tip that guy?
Yeah, I tipped the server. I tipped the server, yeah. And this is the first time. You and I talked about this before tipping, right? I don't like being told that I have to tip someone. You know, I don't like, you know, when there's like a party of six or more and it's built into the check and all the sorts of that. Floyd is a big charitable guy, and so he's actually spent quite a bit of time in Japan after the earthquake there, helping with the refugees. He would cook for the refugees. You know, remarkable man.
Mm.
And in fact, he and I got on this discussion because I love Japanese curry. I mean, it's the most delicious bowl, just rice with like shredded chicken in this delicious curry. Tastes nothing like Indian curry. And so all the Japanese were asking, because they knew of his Indian descent, if he had a command of curry, could he do this? So he learned how to make Japanese curry while he was there. But he was saying that when he was in Japan, that he was doing all the stuff for the refugees. And so back home, on the check, when you're checking out, the server explained to me, he said, you'll see a thing on there says for this one, it was a name of a charity. So he had the tip, and then there was a line for this name of this charity. Then he explained it to me and said, you know, Floyd is very passionate about it, and it like worked with children with like brain tumors to sort of help realize their dream and these are sort of post-surgery brain tumor children and stuff. And it was just like, oh, God, gut-wrenching. You know, I'm like, yes, big tip for them. You know, like I just added that to the tip. I just kept adding tips. You know, if they would have put another line that's like, do you want to tip this guy? I just kept adding it. You know, I was like, but I'd never seen that before. So there was like a line and they had the name of the charity typed out. And I was like, what is that? It was pretty neat.
Very interesting, sir. Very interesting. I don't get up that way often. But I wouldn't mind checking that place out.
Yeah, you know, it's just watching his Twitter stream is fun too, because I just saw a tweet that he was like, you know, up here we're quartering a cow, you know, and they bought the restaurant bought a whole cow, and he was up in upstate New York or something like doing, you know, taking apart the cow and you know it was going to be served in the restaurant. And so then I saw that, and then we were there, and he had hanging in the refrigerator area, the dry aged area, like part of this cow that they were going to be serving. And he's like, yeah, we're working on that. It's not ready yet, but in two nights we're going to be serving that up. And sure enough, I saw his tweet saying, you know, on the menu tonight, you know, is we're doing this, and this cut of meat. And I thought, you know, just a love of what he does, you know, a love of his art, a love of his career, and you know that he would have such passion about that, to be so intimately involved. He's not one of these guys who like owns a restaurant and never goes. You know, he was there on the line, like working with the food, and he prepared like this little dessert for my wife, and it was just incredible. So yeah, if you get a chance, go there. It's a lot of love in that place, and it's, you know, I like to be a part of people who care a lot about what they do and to witness that. And so this guy definitely top notch.
Mm-hmm. Glad to hear he has a healthy stream on Twitter. We're not speaking about it at all, but we're going to speak about it right now. There's something very important that we need to tell you about, and we need to get you, the Egghead Army, involved. And as we're going about telling you this, we're going to give you a very special URL. So you're going to need to get ready to write this down or put it into an email or tweet it out. We may be tweeting it out as well.
That's right.
In our healthy stream, it's about our new show sponsors, Squarespace. Have you heard of them? We used to talk about them quite a lot. Then for a while, we weren't talking about them so much. And now we're talking about them again. And that's because Squarespace 6 is here.
That's right. The brand new Squarespace. And if you haven't had a chance to go, if you don't know what we're talking about, just go to squarespace.com/grizzly. That's our URL. And just sign up. It's free. If you're thinking about starting a website or a blog, or maybe you've got some photos of the family and you want to put them online so the whole family can see them around the country, around the world, create a simple website. You know, just call it whatever your family's, you know, photo gallery, and create an incredible photo website. Or you're thinking about starting a business. You know, I know some folks who are actually trying to start a pet sitting business. And they asked me, what did I recommend for a website? I said, I can't recommend any other website than Squarespace. They are fantastic. It's so easy. With all of the drag and drop capabilities that you can do on building a website, you don't have to worry about writing any code or anything. So when you sign up, try it for free. You don't even need a credit card. And just play around with it. Play around with building your website. They have all kinds of templates you can choose from. So let's say you want to create like a storefront. You might choose this particular template or that particular template. You put the name of your business on the top of the page. Then you want to put some photos of the people who work there, maybe the outside of the shop. Put a page devoted to finding directions to your business. You can put a beautiful little map right in the center of it. They have all kinds of forms, drag and drop capability. It's so simple. I mean, I think, Mike, you, like me, are sort of blown away how easy it is to build a website with them.
This is one of the best things about the new Squarespace 6. Just to give you a sense of how forward-thinking they are, let's say you use their photo uploader, right? You want to put something out there that's photo intensive, right? Maybe you got a photo essay you want to publish, or you like to do photo rich, really robust looking blog entries. You drag and drop a photo on your desktop, and it's going to automatically resize it to 6 different sizes so that any device, from the smallest mobile device right up to maximum, you know, right on your monitor screen with all the landscape available to it, so that it's optimized no matter what screen views what you're doing. That happens automatically. You never have to go back in and resize everything. It's completely optimized for that experience, no matter what device people are looking at your site on. It's really an ingenious step forward from our friends over at Squarespace, and we want to get you in on the act.
Yeah.
So we want you to go to squarespace.com/grizzly, and you're going to use Egghead. That's one word. Egghead. That has 2 G's in it, like the Vincent Price villain from the 60s Batman, all right? And we want you to play around, and we want you to build something. Build something for yourself, or build the Clayton Morris tribute site of your dreams. And then we want you to send it to us. We're going to pick at least one that we really, really like, that really shows off the versatility of Squarespace 6, and we're going to give the person who builds it something pretty awesome.
Yeah, so it's, again, free to sign up, and you can make a couple of these websites. So you no credit card at all. No credit card. It's free. Free to sign up. And then like Mike said, if you decide to keep your website, it's very cheap. They have 2 different plans. Very, very cheap. I think it's like $8.99 is the starting plan, and then I think like $16 a month is the upper plan. Unlimited bandwidth. It's incredible. Then you'll use that coupon code Egghead. That'll get you 10% off for the life of your website. 10% off. You can't beat that. It's already cheap enough, and then you're going to take another 10% off. So just go there and create any website about the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe or anything that we talk about here on the show. Be creative, whether it's Batman or Breaking Bad or Mike Nesmith or Mike Quackenbush or anything you can think of that's creative and entertaining. We're going to look at these. So get your entries in. You have all month to do it. And at the end of the month, we're going to give you some great prizes. You're not going to believe, worth hundreds of dollars. So our friends over at Scotty Vest have already donated some great prizes. So you're going to get $150 credit. You can buy anything you want at scottyvest.com. But so we're going to give some great stuff away. Create the most incredible websites you can think of. Play around with it. Go over to squarespace.com/grizzly right now and sign up for free. And again, you can make as many websites as you want. Just get to learn how to use it. And once you do, you're going to be blown away how easy it is. So our thanks to Squarespace for sponsoring the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. We appreciate it.
That's right. We make a lot of great content here on the Grizzly Productions Network. I know that as I have been the executive vice treasurer now for 2 consecutive terms here at Grizzly Productions. And all of our great shows are delivered to you free of charge. There's not a single one that we charge you for. And that's because of great show sponsors like Squarespace and our longtime friends over at Cobra Electronics, who we'll tell you about just a little bit later on in today's program.
Indeed. Hey, did you see some of this? I don't know if I sent you this or not earlier in the week. It raised my interest about – now we're getting some of the results from the summer movie blockbusters.
Mm-hmm.
And The Dark Knight Rises has topped The Avengers in a 2012 summer poll about their favorite movies.
Okay.
So I thought that was interesting, which sort of ruled supreme this year, and it happened to be Christopher Nolan's final film, got the Best Movie Trophy, a count of 63% to The Avengers' 20%.
It was his last in the Batman trilogy, not his last film ever.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Unless something really bad happens to him. Hey, did you hear Ving Rhames died?
What? Are you kidding? Michael Clark Duncan died.
Right. I always get those 2 confused.
Really?
As soon as I see him, Ving Rhames. Whoops. No, that's not Ving Rhames.
Yeah.
And they don't really look alike either.
No, not at all. And I had a chance to meet Michael Clark Duncan. I think I told you this years ago when I worked out in Los Angeles, and he was a super nice guy. And I sat, I think I had breakfast with him in the studio. We sat there for like an hour. Just the most gracious guy. And this was on the heels of his Oscar nomination.
For The Green Mile.
Yeah.
Right?
So he was – it was after the Oscars, I think, and he was in our studio. So he had already like – I think he lost, right? He didn't win an Oscar for that, did he?
I don't think he did.
Yeah. But he's just the most gracious guy, down to earth. And I guess he had some heart tear and then after surgery and then ended up dying. Really sad. Yeah.
That sounds pretty awful. Yeah. Hey, what were you in for? My heart was torn.
Right. And it wasn't the metaphorical kind either.
Right. What is that, a Journey song?
Although I did find it odd. He was engaged to be married to Omarosa. Remember her from Omarosa from the Apprentice? She's like that really kind of
abrasive.
Like he seems like a gentle giant. Maybe that's why.
Right. Opposites attract, just like Paula Abdul and MC Scat Cat. I think that's where it's at. Ah, that frisky animated feline.
Oh, I love that you know MC Scat Cat. I happen to know that name as well. I'm gonna look up.
You know MC Scat Cat as well.
I do. I just didn't want to admit it publicly. I might to my wife.
On the topic. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. I was talking about summer movies here, and I meant to tell you about this. I don't know if you saw the five best and worst movies of 2012.
Oh, tell me, what were the best movies of 2012?
Well, on this list, and this is I guess where does this come from?
Right, that's the important. Who's the source on this?
Well, the five big winners, I guess. So they're looking at the overall sort of box office numbers, but it looks like The Dark Knight Rises has beat now The Avengers for overall box office numbers. At $1 billion, just crested this Labor Day weekend to $1 billion, Dark Knight Rises, which
so
I think...
its worldwide total is now bigger than The Avengers? That would mean that is now the number three highest grossing film of all time.
I believe that's correct. Wow. I saw that this weekend. Let me do a little bit more digging on that. But first, here are these are the sort of the big winners for the summer as far as like audience reaction they did this. I don't know. They did this whole sort of, I guess, algorithm to look at what was the best. So the number one was The Avengers. Yeah, number one is The Avengers for well received. It accounted for 15% of Hollywood's entire box office this summer. But it wouldn't even be that big of a deal. But it just did such a good job of how it worked and stayed together. Spider-Man, The Amazing Spider-Man. It's a bit of an unpopular selection here, as they point out. But this movie did good work as a reboot because it's actually a new film. Didn't try to compete with the same elements that made Sam Raimi's Spider-Man movies great. Dark Knight Rises comes in at number three. Number four was Ted, which is the Mark Wahlberg.
Jack Black is in that, right?
Yeah. So it's Mark Wahlberg is in it as well, and it's that teddy bear movie.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently it's very dirty, but very funny.
Mm.
Number five on the list is Magic Mike.
Wow.
I don't know. That's kind of bizarre.
People like that Matthew McConaughey.
Can you name the five biggest losers of the year?
Five biggest losers?
Yeah.
Wow. Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Dog Days.
No, I don't see that on here.
No. Whatever that Katy Perry movie was.
Was there a Katy Perry movie?
Yeah. Wasn't that like the only thing that opened against The Dark Knight Rises was like this Katy Perry movie? Speaking of, I see this on the rack at Target whenever I'm going to the checkout. Did you know that there's a Miley Cyrus movie called LOL?
No.
Yes. I don't know that it was ever in theaters. I don't know enough about it. But it's like right there on the DVD rack, like in there with like all the current new releases. Like there's Ice Age, you know, or whatever else just came out. And it's like her laying on a bed texting on her phone. And the title is just LOL, Miley Cyrus. Like, wow. How is that getting made? Like, is she still really popular?
Yeah, apparently. So here are the top five worst films.
Yeah, give it to me.
Number one. Actually, I'll start at five and go down, see if you can hit number one. Number five is Snow White and the Huntsman.
Wow, all right.
Now, that's starring Chris Hemsworth. So he was in both The Avengers, of course, as Thor, and Snow White and the Huntsman as one of the worst films of the year. The Watch is fourth on this list.
Oh, okay. I can't believe that even came out. Like, that seemed like it must have been... in and out so fast.
Yeah, just that was the Ben Stiller, Vaughn movie where they're kind of like Ghostbusters.
Mm-hmm.
That was there. Number three, Total Recall.
Mm.
The remake of the, you know, incredible first version, the original Arnold Schwarzenegger Total Recall. So this was a blah.
Yeah.
Number two, Rock of Ages.
Oh. couple people I know actually put that over to me. They said it was surprising how much they enjoyed it. But I guess the composers of this list disagreed.
It looks like that, you know, everyone's praising Tom Cruise's performance in it. They're like, he, you know, even, you know, his great performance, he's the only one that brought it in this film. Mm. And number one, can you name the worst film of 2012 through the summer, you know, through the summer blockbuster months? Because I'm sure we'll see some Oscar contenders hit, you know, towards Christmas.
Battleship?
Bingo.
Really? All right.
You sunk my battleship. Number one. So there you go. So anyway, we had promised people we were going to talk about something this week. Are we going to?
Yes, we are. Now, I'm surprised I haven't talked about this on the trending show, because this has certainly been a lot. There's been a lot of talk in the social sphere about this. But the 12 dates of the Monkees Autumn Mini Tour have all sold out. They sold out instantly. Most of them sold out in less than 24 hours, which has really surprised concert promoters, because it seems as if they don't know that Davy Jones is dead. This is a big deal.
Yeah, they're not aware. They think they're going to see it. They're going to be a lot of people pissed in the audience.
Right.
Who are like, where's Davy Jones?
Right. No, I had to make a couple calls for you and I to get tickets to this thing.
Right.
And I was amazed that in the chain of people that I had to consult about this, they were like, why are these tickets so hard to get? Is it all of them? And I said no, because the one's dead. Like, they're a trio now.
Right.
Like, yeah, did you miss that? Davy Jones died. Some people did miss that. But yeah, I was amazed at how many, like, of the go-between types were like, yeah, I don't know why these are so hard to get this time around. But luckily, we did get some, and we got some pretty good seats. And we're going to go see that. So, but that's not really probably what everybody was hoping we would talk about. The timing is interesting in that I just finished watching season 4 of Breaking Bad. And the 5th season reached the halfway mark. And now it goes on hiatus for almost a year before they're going to come back and wrap the series up.
Have you started watching any of the 5th season yet?
No. You know, I was really lucky in that I recently was out in the Midwest and had to spend a lot of time in a car and got to get caught up on like all of season 4, but I have not yet started season 5.
Because there is an episode in season 5 that you are going to lose your mind over.
Is this the one that includes the Monkees song "Going Down"?
Who ruined it for you?
Mickey Dolenz was tweeting about it.
Ah,
so
well, that Mickey Dolenz. Who's that guy?
I know, right? He apparently was not so hot at the use of that song.
It was great. It was so
well
done. He
felt like something about the way it's used in the episode. Now, I don't know because I haven't watched it yet, but something about it, I think, didn't sit well with him. Like
I think I could – how? I mean, if you can wrap your mind around when they use musical montages on that show, I think you can probably come to an understanding of what he's talking about. Mm-hmm. When there's a musical interlude, it usually involves – well, I'm not going to ruin it. You need to see it. Reserve judgment, but it was very, very well done, and I about lost my – I felt like telling you. I'm like, he hasn't seen it yet. I can't ruin it. So anyway, season 4, you just wrapped up, and I mean, overall, first of all, let's start at the beginning, right? Because I think you and I were on the edge of our seats with the end of season 3 wondering how – did he in fact kill Gail Bedecker?
Right.
What was your response? I mean, you and I kind of had these conspiracy theories about what unfolded right at the beginning of season 4. Did he kill him? Did he maybe shoot off to the side because they had that weird sort of camera move and that maybe he sort of shot to scare him, wound him, whatever, you know, whatever it was. But in the end, he ended up killing him. Were you surprised by that?
I was, because this was a real change for Jesse's character, you know. I think that's one of the things about this series that makes it so addictive is that when you watch other episodic television programs, or really you experience that in any type of ongoing fictional narrative, so many times something momentous happens, but the characters remain unchanged. You know, you come back the next episode and there are no repercussions, you know. Whereas in this series, there is a real sense of the grander continuity, that everything has some kind of impact, right? Like, I think the best and most overt example of that is the chain of events that led to the airline crash earlier on in the series, right? Like where you could see where these things exactly going all the way back to what Walt did led this air traffic controller to make the error in judgment that caused the plane to crash, that you could see the domino effect. And those, you know, the effect of that is felt throughout. And it's interesting to see this change from Jesse, whereas previously, like, you know, we had just kind of seen Walt making increasingly immoral decisions as he went along. But he would at times have to do the dirty work for Jesse. And this became a real change in his character, I thought.
And I also thought it was interesting to see the change in, or not the change in, but the overt display of violence from Gus. Mm-hmm. Of course, he shows up at the one point, doesn't say a word, and that incredibly tense scene when they show up at the lab at the you know, and they're sitting there, Jesse and Walt, not sure as he keeps pleading with him. You just want Walt to shut up, to mm-hmm. not say anything more, as it's, you know, just worry that he's just going to keep talking and he's going to get himself killed somehow. Mm-hmm. Gus shows up, of course, and Victor had taken upon himself to cook. He ends up slitting his throat with the box cutter. Mm-hmm. And then he simply changes back into his work clothes, back into his fastidious outfit, and then he mm-hmm. goes back to work. And he doesn't say a word the entire time, right? If I'm not mistaken, he doesn't say a word. He just leaves.
Right, yeah. He utterly ignores them and anything that they're saying or doing. And
Was Mike there at the time?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, he's very, very cold and calculating. And I saw an interview with the actor who plays Gus, where he said, you know, this is the most, he's the coolest cucumber you'll ever come across. And in the finale then, of course, where it all comes back around and it's time for Gus to get his comeuppance, even there he's still, right, and he walks right out of that hospital room and fixes his tie.
Right.
You know, so he's a fascinating character, as are they all. And I recently had the opportunity, I did an unbelievably long seminar over the weekend, and one of the things that I'm typically called on to talk about is character, about the way in which you make personas which resonate with a larger audience, the way in which we can convey that through our body language and our facial expressions and the vocalizations that we choose for ourselves and things like that. And I find myself increasingly referencing Breaking Bad when I teach these types of seminars or clinics, or even just to my at a regular class I might do at the Wrestle Factory for aspiring professional wrestler types there. In that, the thing that's great about this series is that Walt to me is the heart of it, is because he's so clearly defined. You fully understand his motive and rationale, that no matter how far off the beaten path he strays, you're still invested in him. Even when he's doing horrific, heinous things,
right,
you're still invested in him.
Wait, and even in the season 5, it's even worse, and you're still invested in him. Because if you weren't, the show wouldn't work.
Right, exactly. You would give up on it. You know, like, you wouldn't stick around. I think, to me, after Walt, my favorite character is Mike. You know, that's my very favorite character. And whenever those two are in conflict with each other, that's supremely interesting to me. Like that scene in the bar where Mike just beats Walter up.
Right.
You know, like, Walter makes the overture to him, like, just get him in a room with me and I'll do the rest. And Mike just beats the crap out of him. I love that. I love the interaction between the two of them. You know, they're both very, very driven. They're both very, very committed to their paths. And when they butt heads like that, I think that's some of the most delicious stuff in the series. Because, it's a series that's really cast brilliantly. Like, everyone just plays their role magnificently. And a real testimony to that and the writing, and this to me reminds me of Lost, is how from episode to episode they will toy with the way you feel about the characters. You know, I used to feel that way about John Locke, that you would love John Locke for an episode or two, and then you would just hate him. And then he'd find a way, and you'd think, oh, God, I really want to see him prevail. I feel that way a lot about some of the females, like Marie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really, for a while there, I was like, oh, that character just drives me up the wall. And then she becomes oddly sympathetic.
Right.
As the series goes on. And as the fourth season was ending, this one only kind of kept building for me, because even though you can sort of see the twists and turns along the way, I really think, and I don't know, I haven't watched any of season five yet, but I think I really want to see something bad happen to Skylar. Like, I really want something bad to happen to her. I want that character to pay a penance. Like, I'm not saying, what's the name of that actress? Anna Gunn?
I think
is
you're
that
right.
Her name
yeah.
that plays her? I don't want her to be out of work. Don't misconstrue what I'm saying. I'm not saying Anna Gunn is a bad actress. I'm not saying I wish she was off the show or anything. The Skylar character needs to pay a penance, and I want something bad to happen to that character.
I did enjoy the journey this season with her sort of breaking bad a little bit in order to protect her family with the car wash, and I enjoyed seeing her become the manipulator. You know, she convinces mm-hmm. Walt to meet with Saul to buy the car wash. Walt really doesn't want to go along with it. Then she has this whole plan where she's going to try to trick the owner into selling by having this one of these guys from Saul basically come out and be like a water tester. You right. know, and shuts down the business because of this whole soil is contaminated and it's going to cost him more or whatever it is than it was going to cost her to fix it and the whole thing. So she then suddenly, you know, he calls and unloads it. Mm-hmm. And then she hangs up on him, basically tells him that she wants actually less. She wants more money from or she's going to offer less money than she originally offered. And he calls back 5 minutes later and, you know, that whole time. So it was fascinating to see. I mean, and you're going to get your. I think in part, I won't ruin anything for you, but you'll enjoy season five then, in part. You know, with Skylar, because things just kind of go off the rails a bit. But I like the story. They're working on this story as the cover-up, right? The money laundering scheme that has to then take place at the car wash.
Mm-hmm.
And I do. You begin to sense some things with Walt, right? Because at the heart of all of this was the fact that he always just felt like a man contained, right? And then when mm-hmm. he got the cancer, he became unhinged. He just was like, I'm not going to live contained anymore. I'm going to live the life that I've just always wanted to live and how I'm going to live it.
Mm-hmm.
And you really start to see that take hold in this season as he mm-hmm. starts to try to position himself to take over the operation from Gus, and to, you know, to try to protect himself. I mean, at the beginning of the season, you think, my God, there's no way he can get out of this, right? He's trapped mm-hmm. here. Gus is slitting the throat of this guy. But then throughout the season, they, you know, very craftily go about trying to bring down Gus.
Mm-hmm. I like the way that, and this is really just about the writing again, that they paint Walt into a corner and then sit back and kind of watch how he gets his way out, you know, because you really do. They're expert at making you feel like the walls are closing in here and there's no escape. And, you know, they constantly have to find ways to do it. And they're surprising ways, you know, like really how the season begins with Jesse making a very surprising choice. And that's been really, really intriguing. Like I don't know of any other series where they are as expert at creating that sense of dramatic tension where you just feel like, I don't see a way out here. And that's why, you know, I'm sure if you watch it on Netflix or something like that, like you I just got to watch the next one right now. It doesn't matter that it's 2 a.m. Like, right. I have to watch the next one right now.
There's, of course, the whole Ted Beneke angle about him having to deal with the IRS, of course, the auditing that he has to go through. And again, another crafty move by Skylar to take some of the money that Walt has earned and hand it over to Ted. I mean, it's sort of the ultimate slap in the face, right? Of course, he then, in that crawl space episode, is laying there laughing maniacally when he learns that she had given the money to Ted. He just can't believe it. He just starts laughing uncontrollably, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, I thought he was dead. I thought Ted Beneke was dead, right?
Yeah, they certainly – I think they want you to think that. I don't know if that's true, but they certainly want you to think that.
When the two toughs come from Saul, right? It was Saul, right, who got those guys to come.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they're sitting there, and he runs across the floor, slips on the rug, and smashes his head. And you think, oh, my God, he's broken his neck. He's dead.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's only, I think, a couple episodes later you realize that he's he might be still around, I think. I don't know.
Right. Yeah, well, if that's the case, that happens in season five. But I had a suspicion that that was not the last.
Well, they never addressed it. They never talked about it. And
They do. They tease you a little bit. Like, Saul says something like, I never expected that to happen. But they're vague enough.
Right.
You know, they kind of dangle that out there for you. Like,
Yeah, so that, that's fascinating, the way that that unfolds. So you'll see some more of that then, I guess, in season five. I'd forgotten where one cut off and one began. But I think the really interesting thing is how large a role now Jesse takes in this season, right?
Mm-hmm.
And heads off to become sort of Mike's right-hand man.
Mm.
And so let's go back to this, because I think this is fascinating. When Gus begins to make Jesse feel relevant, right? He makes him... He tells Mike to bring him on these journeys with him. They stage that whole whatever... what would you call that? A stick-up?
Right, yeah. They wanted to see how he would react, so they kind of fabricated a situation where he thought he was about to get robbed and watched how he behaved.
Now, is that, do you think, and I'm trying to remember this part of the season, which is, was it all in an effort to undermine Walt? Was that the whole goal? It seems like Gus would have bigger fish to fry than care about the emotions of Walt.
I really
felt like...
Trying
to pit them
against
each other? And what was the end game, you know?
To me, this is what I thought they were that they were doing, was they were setting up the idea, when I believed that they wanted to kill Jesse, that they were going to take him out on these, little missions, and then he would conveniently get killed by, like, a rival gang that was in reality all set up by Gus, so they could go back to Walt and say, look, we didn't kill him, these guys did. And that way the heat wouldn't be on them. And that's how they were going to get rid of Jesse. But then as it went on, and he even had dinner with Gus, you realize that they had some other plan for him. So then my theory about that was kind of out the window.
It's amazing to me the loyalty that Jesse continued to show, of course, for Walt, despite the things that were unfolding with the child.
Mm-hmm.
Are we led to believe then with the child that... Well, that's not... Is that season five?
Well, at the end of season four... The parting shot is that the
okay, good.
The
this
plant,
is season four. Right.
The plant that had poisoned the kid that kept Jesse in the hospital all that time, the Lily of the Valley, was sitting in Walt's backyard. And I think they clearly wanted you to think, whether or not you bid on it or not, was that Walt had poisoned the kid to motivate Jesse, which I thought was an intriguing swerve. And again, like, that really says something, I think, when you walk away from this thinking, like, all you really want is for Walt to prevail, and yet I'm pretty sure what they want you to think at this moment is that he just poisoned a little boy.
Right. Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, that's mm-hmm. what I thought. I thought, here's a master of chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
He knew the kid wouldn't die
mm-hmm.
If treated properly.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's sort of a remarkable turn, so... One person we haven't really talked about, but who really, I think, has the Emmy Award winning actor, or the person who deserves an Emmy for his performance in this, is Hank.
Yes, he is. Yeah, I don't know that he's the unsung hero. Maybe only in this review has he been unsung, but he's excellent, and I really like that. I think in the beginning they tried to set him up as this like blowhard, who was kind of. Maybe a bit of a boob, and you really get to see that he's a really smart detective.
Yeah.
That he is really quite clever. And I don't know, obviously they really enjoy misleading you on this series. They like to lead you down these paths. I have to think that maybe one of the big reveals at the end is going to be is that Hank knew it was Walt all along.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I just finished season 5.1, so mm-hmm. I'm not going to ruin anything. But you kind of have mm-hmm. to feel like let me tell you how I felt after season four. I thought, okay, Gus is out of the picture,
mm-hmm.
And that they're going to be tying up loose ends now, right? I mean, the DEA, mm-hmm. that's not it. Gus is gone. Hey, bye bye. That's it. How did this thing come to be? We don't even know how this thing happened. We got to start. So you kind of get this feeling, like I felt this way the whole series, that they're on a collision course.
Yes.
There are always those interesting meals that they have, either in the back of Walt's house or in the back of Hank's house, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or the cocktails that they enjoy together once in a while. And there's always, I mean, I look forward to those dinner meetings between them because there's always some little nugget, mm-hmm. some little uncomfortable moment
right.
that you look forward to between the two of them. Something that Walt will say just to tease him. And I think there was that moment in this where he did tease him about something, right? Where Hank started looking into something because Hank said it. Do you remember what that was? Was that
right,
in this season?
Right. Walt, he drank too much at dinner the one night. He really reinvigorated Hank because Hank was ready to put, you know, he said, it feels like closure. You know, this was the guy I was chasing. This was Heisenberg and he's out of the question or he's out of the picture. And perhaps a little bit drunk, Walt starts to ramble and he says, you know, this guy is really an amateur. This can't be your Heisenberg. Maybe that guy's still out there. You know, he's kind of full of himself in that moment. And that kind of puts Hank back on the case. And that's a big turnaround for Hank's character who, you know, had kind of been in a downward spiral the whole season. And then all of a sudden you start to realize that, you know, that he is very astute. And he surprises him. And Walt realizes that he kind of brought the heat back on himself.
Yeah. And interestingly, of course, then he begins to uncover all of these little connections throughout the whole season. And, and then you have Walt and Jesse involved with Mike going down to Mexico, of course. And then the whole thing with this Mexican cartel down there, you learn the sort of back history of Gus and how involved he was with this cartel and with promises and, you know, how he was almost killed and beaten to a pulp. Of course, Gus is it Don Eladio?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The guy, you know, he's finally bringing him his operation. So mm-hmm. he wants to show this incredibly pure product. He has Jesse go down there to make it for him, the whole thing. They fly to their meth lab in Mexico. A great scene, too, with Jesse telling these guys what a dirty lab they're running.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't, where's the methylamine? Where's this? Where's that? And he only does it by color code. He doesn't know, like, all the breakdowns of everything and the math. He just knows based on sight how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the famous poison scene, which was just really cool at the poolside.
Right.
That Gus had taken this antidote, but still, you know, has to be taken to a doctor. And then everyone just begins collapsing all over the place. It was a really great scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, and that again was, they just keep kind of building Gus up, you know, throughout this. It's been a steady arc as he just becomes more and more dangerous. And, it gives such a greater gravity to the whole situation as you see him now just slaughtering people. and then I think that really, for season five, having not seen any of it yet, like it just raises the anticipation because it raises the stakes so much that now who can really fill his shoes? Because you see what it's required of the person that runs this operation, how cold-blooded that they have to be. And it seems to, at least to me, like it obviously sets up Walt and Mike on a collision course, which to me is what I've wanted to see all along.
Mm. And you'll be thrilled about season five. Season five is not a letdown, and you'll begin to see these things we've been talking about, right? The Hank thing and the Mike thing and all of this sort of coming together. But you're right. Who can fill the shoes of Gus? And that's sort of what season five hinges on. Mm-hmm. Also the relationship, you know, what's going to happen with Skylar? Like, what's going to happen with this family? Can she continue in this way?
Mm-hmm.
You know, can she go on like this? Then what happens with Hank as he gets better? Is he more emboldened or does he just forget about things? You know, so it'll be, I kind of already know where things are going and boy, I can't wait for you to watch season five, but yeah, is there anything else in season four we wanted to talk about? I think at the end, of course, you know, he says, I won. You know, he calls Skylar to let her know that he won. He was the mm-hmm. winner. You know, and then, of course, if you haven't yet watched season five, you'll know that on the season five poster, it shows Walter White sitting on a huge pile of money in his lab coat saying, "All hail the king."
Mm.
That was, of course, the teaser poster they put out there before season five kicked off. So,
yeah, I did. One thing that I did like about this early on, you definitely didn't get any of it, was maybe in the first three or four episodes. There was even one or two episodes where there was no Walter Jr. whatsoever. And I was really intrigued to see more of him. And there were one or two episodes where he really is in it quite a bit. You know, there's the one where he stays at Walter's and takes care of him after Walter gets beaten up. So I really, really like the fact that they gave him a little more time to shine, because I think that's a really interesting character. And generally, he's downplayed. You know, of the supporting players, he probably gets the least screen time of all of them.
Yeah.
So,
was this the season where Marie is out on? She's stealing from real estate open houses.
I believe so.
She's out there, like, kind of popping in different places, and she keeps making up different stories about her. You know, to say, oh yeah, my husband does this, and we're looking for a place, and then she runs into that other real estate agent like a couple of times.
Yes, yeah.
She just keeps stealing random things.
If not, it was season three, but it was definitely very recently where that happens, where, you know, she's out there, and eventually, whether or not it's her attempting to get Hank's attention because he has to come and save her when she gets arrested, or what that was, but that was kind of the whole arc where you really began to kind of sympathize with her character. Because previous to that, yeah, I found her intolerable.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was really sad about the way in which Jesse's character was going. Like, he just having like these, oh, you know, drug-filled parties at his house, and you just wonder, like, when is he going to let it end? But he's like, numbing himself, like, from what he, you know, killing Gail Bedecker. Like, just the reverberations. It's not something he can get over, because he's never been the one to kill anyone. It's been Walt.
Right.
And Walt seems to be able to compartmentalize and get over it pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of the end of the innocence for Jesse as it relates to that, you know. He'd always kind of kept the blood off of his hands up until that moment.
Yeah.
And you can see the dark trajectory that it puts him on. And, yeah, it's outstanding stuff.
Yeah.
There's a reason why it is so – and I read that online. Someone even said, that season four was the recipient of universal acclaim. No mistakes in season four.
And 13 Emmy nominations, and so you have 8 episodes in season 5.1, so which just wrapped up. So once Mike is done with those on his next road trip, we'll jump in and have a discussion about season 5.1. Because it seems like a completely – well, not a completely different show. The heart of it's still there, but there's a lot of new stuff. There's a lot of new stuff, and it's pretty cool.
Hey, a quick update before we tell you about Cobra Electronics, based on something we said earlier in the episode. The Dark Knight Rises has crossed the $1 billion mark worldwide, and it's even surpassed The Dark Knight.
That's right. But it has not done The Avengers?
No. The Avengers is way ahead.
Okay.
The Avengers is over $1.5 billion. Mm. So it has a large margin that it has to make up there. Just past the $1 billion mark for The Dark Knight Rises, while The Avengers is past the $1.5 billion mark. And The Avengers is still playing in some markets, to my amazement. It's still showing on 1,700 screens in North America.
Really?
Despite the fact that it was released in May. Yeah, isn't that crazy?
I mean, I guess it goes to those dollar theaters and the smaller theaters that don't get it initially.
Right. And I don't know if you saw this, but for one day, the full Avengers movie was on YouTube.
Really?
Yeah, it took Disney about 24 hours to get it taken down, but the Avengers was on YouTube for a day.
Monetize that, man.
Yeah. I think probably what happened is somebody got themselves in a buttload of trouble.
Yeah, I would think so. And the DVD, the Blu-ray and DVD are coming out, I think, like in a few weeks.
Right, about 2 weeks, I think.
Yeah. So I can't wait to see that. Yeah, because I only saw that the one time in the theater. Unlike The Dark Knight Rises, which I've seen now, I think, 4 times in the theater.
Wow. And so, that's a serious investment of time, because that is not a short film.
No. And, you know, my wife had asked to go see it a second time. No, I'm sorry. I saw it 3 times. Yeah, 3 times. 3 times. So, yeah, we saw it the first time together, and she said, you know, it was like 2 days later, and she's like, it just was resonating so much with her. She's like, you want to go see that again? I was like, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. You don't have to twist my arm for that. So anyway, we're going to pause here and thank our final show sponsor of the week. Yes, they are of the week. And our friends over at Cobra. You know, if you're not used to what these guys do, let's just give you a little sort of backstory about how these guys kind of came together. I mean, they kind of came together figuring out common problems that we all have and trying to find sort of an electronic or gadget solution for it, right? Like losing your keys, losing your smartphone. They created the Cobra Tag, so you'll never lose your keys again, and it pairs with your smartphone. getting lost. They have an incredible array of GPS and ultimate detection systems, like the Vedetta system, mm-hmm. which is brand new. So, you know, one of the problems that you have with like those GPS things and the radar detectors in your car is that they need to lay flat to read the radar. I mean, I guess that's why like the stealth aircraft are flat on the bottom, because mm-hmm. they can avoid radar detection. So these things needed to be propped and laid there, and you can almost not see them. Now they created the Vedetta system, which actually sits upright. So the screen flips up almost like a little mini, like Star Trek screen.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual unit itself still remains flat to pick up the radar. So it's brilliant, right? It seems like a simple solution that no one's thought of. So they have the little pop-up screen, but the unit itself still lays flat to read the radar, like the stealth aircraft. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the Cobra Eye radar detection system that you have in your car. Now, you are on this long road trip. You bring it all the time when you go on those?
Yeah, anytime. Whether I'm traveling in a group or I'm traveling by myself, I always take it on the road with me. And the Cobra Eye radar system, you could probably boil it down in this way. You could say, this is going to prevent me from getting a ticket, right? Because if someone's clocking you for speed or something like that, or makes you aware of traffic intersections where there are red light cameras, if you have a tendency to cut those yellow lights a little too closely. But, I mean, that aside, and that is a real function. I can say this in all honesty. I haven't gotten a single ticket since I've gotten my Cobra Eye radar system. That is the absolute truth. And I was like the once-a-year kind of speeding ticket sort of guy.
You were.
That was about my average there, yeah.
It's a good average.
But I don't want to go any heavier than that, let me tell you. But it does make you a safer and more alert driver all around. You just become so hyper-aware of all the driving hazards out there. And that's because all the information that comes through that system gets updated and re-verified twice a day.
Yeah, check them out. They have a whole array of products over at Cobra.com. You can find their stuff on Amazon, of course. And as we head into the holiday season, these are some great gadgets to give for your loved one. Whether it's you're caring about someone who you want them to be safe while they drive, or you want them to not be forgetful anymore and never have to lose their keys ever again. You can check out all of their great products. Again, Cobra.com. We thank them for their longtime support of the Grizz.
Mm-hmm. And right now, both those great gadgets and a whole lot more are on deep, deep discount when you check the specials section on their left-hand navigation there.
Ooh, I'm on there right now. Yeah.
So ooh, that is good. Out.
Yeah.
Right on. So, there was something else I wanted to talk, and now it slipped my mind, of course.
Hmm. Is it a movie?
I don't know.
Is it a comic book? Is it,
No, no. Can't think of what it is. Oh, yeah, holidays. Let's talk about Labor Day. All right?
Didn't we already talk about that?
We did. You know, it's getting close right now. The beast is almost upon us. King of Trios.
Oh, yeah.
It's only the biggest tournament in all of professional wrestling. And, oh, my God, it's less than 2 weeks away. In fact, in reality, for the greater Chikara family, the action really starts next Wednesday when the first guests from Japan start to arrive. And we do. We have an incredible cavalcade.
How do you prepare for
that?
I mean, it seemed like a logistical nightmare to me. How many wrestlers do you have coming? Like hundreds?
There are just on night one of King of Trios, there are 49 different performers.
Ooh.
49 of them all together.
And then, let me tell you something about performers. They're persnickety. Is that safe to say? Like, it's not like you're just getting a group, like it's like a church group getting together for a Bible study,
right?
These are people with like varying personalities. They've got different things going on. They're coming from different parts of the world. They have different ways of preparing for matches, right? Some people like to listen to their iPods to psych themselves out. Some people like to have a big burger, right? All of these like accommodations need to be accounted for in some way or another.
Yeah, and you just have the languages, you know, so there's certain cultural things you've got to be aware of. There's an enormous number. This year, again, we have a lot of performers that are coming from Japan, and they start to arrive next Wednesday. So even though to the world at large, you know, it would appear that King of Trios really begins, and the events do begin next Friday, September 14th in Easton, PA. The reality is that King of Trios, which takes all year to prepare for, starts days in advance as the people start coming in, and we've got to move them around from, you know, whether they're flying into New York City or wherever, and we've got to get them to Easton. We've got to get everybody there on time really early. We've got to make sure we've got, whether it's translators or other people to kind of help them and assistants to make sure that everything goes as smoothly as possible, so that, you know, when on the night and roughly around the time that we advertise, that the whole tournament really does begin. And it does take an enormous amount of preparation on the parts of tons and tons of people. Nothing can really ever prepare you for the day of, because invariably things are going to go wrong, you know. And sometimes it does come down to what you said about just performers and the fact that some people are very, very laid back, but you have such a wide panoply of personalities involved in this. You're going to get people that show up and they're cranky. You're going to get people who show up and they're just ticked off for whatever reason, and there seems to be no method of dealing with it. You're going to have linguistics issues, logistics issues, political issues, everything you can. You have linguini issues. It is a nightmare of our own making, is King of Trios. And I recently, this time of year is when it seems like I do two or three interviews every single day. I'm doing a podcast here and a radio here and something in print over here, because people just King of Trios is really the weekend when the eyes of the entire wrestling universe are upon Chikara. And they like to say, like, you know, what is the real goal of this? And I think the real goal is always just to get out, like to get to Monday.
Right.
Like on Friday, like when you stand up in front of all these people, and you think that, I mean, those are just the performers that you're going to see, those 49 people. And then you start to think about all the support staff, from your announcers to your commentators to your referees, whether there are managers or seconds or valets. Then you start to think about your production crew, the people that do sound, the people that do lights, the people that are going to build the stage. You think about the film crew, the editing crew, the graphics people, and you start to just right down to the people that tear your tickets. It's an enormous and mammoth undertaking, and I'm really glad that it only happens once a year, and maybe should happen less frequently than that going forward.
Yeah, what's the date again?
September 14th, 15th, and 16th. Those are the 3 days. Now, on September 15th, which is Saturday, remember, in the afternoon, we have the fan conclave event in the afternoon. That's an opportunity for you to just kind of meet and mingle with everybody that's going to be there. But one thing, this comes up quite a bit, and there never seems to be like a great forum in which to express this, but obviously these people are coming to be part of the tournament, and several of them have made it really, really clear that should their team be eliminated from the tournament, that they intend to go home. Now, from time to time, we have people that tend to stick around. You know, they might show up in a non-tournament match later on in the weekend, but an overwhelming number of people this year have really made it clear that once their team is eliminated, because by the time we get to night three, only four teams will be left standing, that they intend to go home, that they're not sticking around. So if you want to see everybody, and this, as I said, I mean, the performers from Japan, there's a long list. Manami Toyota, the greatest female professional wrestler of all time, is one of just seven female performers that are coming from Japan. We have representatives from Osaka Pro in Japan, and we have a lot of, whether they evoke the old World Wrestling Federation or Extreme Championship Wrestling. This year, more than any other, we've really gone, I think you'll see there's a tremendous representation of American stars. You know, we've certainly had Japanese stars, we've had European stars in the past, we've had Mexican stars, we've had, you know, more current stars. But for me, just I look at the team of the 1-2-3 Kid Tatanka and the Portuguese Man of War Aldo Montoya. That to me is really like, you know, the early 90s WWF is what that evokes to me.
Yeah.
I don't know that he will, but like if Tatanka shows up with a red streak in his hair, like, oh man, that's going to take me back to 1993.
And that's still his name, right, Tatanka?
It is. You know, an interesting bit of trivia about him is he's one of the only guys to ever negotiate it such that he owns the name. The McMahons do not own the name Tatanka, even though they came up with that for him. You know, previous to that, he wrestled under his name, Chris Chavis. And that's how he got noticed and eventually was hired by the WWF. And they rebranded him Tatanka, which, unless I am mistaken, is a Native American term for buffalo, is what that means.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure there's a song that explains that. But
and he somehow... Dances with Wolves explains it, too.
Oh, okay. So maybe that's where they got the idea. I don't know the exact chronology of that. But he owns all the trademark and legal indicia related to the name Tatanka, so that He can call himself Tatanka independent of the WWF. And there are a couple guys over the years that have been able to do that. You know, the others really kind of have to get the blessing of World Wrestling Entertainment to be able to use that old name of theirs. But Tatanka owns his outright. He's one of the very, very few. I'm 99% sure another instance of that is Demolition. That they actually went to court and they fought to be able to retain the use of that name so they could call themselves Demolition outside of the WWF or now WWE. So, but that is a rare thing because I understand they have a lot of very high-priced and intelligent lawyers on their payroll, does the WWE. And I'm guessing when Linda McMahon is once again trying to run for Senate, you're probably going to need some very intelligent, high-priced lawyers to watch and make sure that all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed.
Yeah, little known fact, too, when in my stint in the WWE, as the Count Clayton Morris, they owned that. I mean, they came up with that.
Right.
They, you know, that was their likeness. And when I left and I went on to wrestle in New Japan, they said, you can't take that with you.
No, and they wouldn't even when you think about the intellectual property of the image of that character, the inverted white amateur wrestling singlet that used to hug your package so tightly.
Right.
They even kept that.
They said, this is going to be out on kids' toys everywhere. And we can't have you taking credit for this.
No, absolutely not. And I do remember for a brief period of time, they thought about having someone else play the part of the Count Clayton Morris. They had recruited Bobby Jaggers for that, but a legal injunction prevented that. So
Mike Starr wasn't available.
Oh, man. I just watched an interview with Barry Horowitz.
Wow.
Who, incidentally, these are the names of what are typically called enhancement talent. These are the guys that on the Saturday morning WWF shows, they were just there to lose. Like, you'd come back from commercial, and they'd already be in the ring.
Right.
They didn't have an entrance of their own. Mike McGurk would just say, already in the ring, Bob Starr.
Already, you know, in the ring.
Right. And there he was, you know, like, taking off his sparkly sequined vest or whatever. But I think the most memorable of all those guys, wouldn't you agree, would you say it was Barry Horowitz?
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, interestingly, we had Ric Flair on the show today.
On what show? On the Grizzly Bear Cafe? I should have shown up earlier.
On the FNF. He's on this morning down there in Charlotte. He's, I guess, North Carolina's native son, right?
Indeed, yeah. Proud product of the Carolinas. He's even like the spokesman for the North Carolina Lotto.
Really?
Yeah.
So, yeah, he was on the show and very, very funny. He did a lot of woos.
Right. He's a very charismatic individual. And unfortunately, I think he's probably – he needs all the help he can get. He's been divorced like 11 times.
Wow.
I think that guy's got – he'll be paying alimony until he's 900 years old, which unfortunately the way the business has aged him these last few years, he's aged like 20 years in the last 3 years.
Yeah, he does not look all that great. I mean, he looked blonde, wispy hair was not well put together, and he looked a little puffy. Because they were showing some older clips of him still in the ring, and yeah, he looked better then, of course, with his tanned hide. But he's looking a little rough, around the edges. Who else did I see? Oh, this week I was going to mention this to you. I don't know if you saw this, but did you see that WWE released an iPad app?
No, I didn't see that.
It's sort of like a history, and I think because you and I talk about so much history of these characters, some of these guys going back years and years and years. The app is actually, I mean, I think it's a free app. I don't know. I think it is a free app, but maybe I'm mistaken. But I saw it on an iPad show, and it's amazing because you can actually click on all the characters, and like a little picture will pop up of them. It's sort of like a rogues gallery. You can swipe from left to right to go through all of the history of these wrestlers who wrestled for them.
Oh, they do have that in the roster section of their full website. And I remember when that rolled out, because the WWE's website within our industry for years was just derided. Like, it was the worst. It looked gaudy. It was you couldn't get around. You couldn't find the info you wanted. And then they rolled out this new roster section, which even has alumni. Like, what sold me on it was there was a Papa Shango profile. But it has every bit of information. You can even watch matches that they've uploaded of all the various superstars. And
right.
Their roster page now is like state of the art. Now you see everybody else in the industry trying to copy what they did.
Yeah, and so in the app, in the iPad app, you can scroll through all of these guys. You can click on Coco Beware. You know, you can just click on these random guys. And when you click on them, then like their bio comes up and their history. And then also a bunch of matches. So some of their like highlight matches, you just tap on and hit play, and you can just start watching one of their matches right there. So these old sort of classic. They even have, like, the even some of the photos are like in black and white from back in the day. So you can click on these guys and watch them. And then I guess it acts like a second screen. So when you're watching like Monday Night Raw or these other things, the app itself becomes a part of the experience. And I don't know in what way, but I just know that they rolled this out. I think it was like last week it rolled out, and I saw some of the features. And to see some of these guys, to see some of these old wrestlers I haven't seen in years in a little display was pretty funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like to go back and watch some of that stuff from time to time. I just recently watched. You remember when Coco Beware was Owen Hart's tag team partner in High Energy? Which was like like an unsung, definitely undercard tag team attraction that I loved. I just saw a Survivor Series match where they got destroyed by the Head Shrinkers. Like, it was during the time when they were really building the Head Shrinkers and Yokozuna up, and oh, they just destroyed High Energy. And as a kid, I was always kind of frustrated. I was probably 12 or 13 when High Energy was put together. I wasn't necessarily a kid, but I could never understand why they never won the big matches. Like, oh, they got beat by Money Inc., and then they got beat by the Beverly Brothers, and they got, you know, oh my God, there was that one awesome six-man tag where High Energy and Max Moon beat the Beverlys and the Genius. But, I never really understood that, you know. To me, they were like the greatest tag team that ever was. Like, why didn't they win the belts? But
right.
You look back at it now, and you're like, yeah, clearly these guys were kind of slotted to be undercard fodder.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I remember them ever walking away with a title.
No, they definitely didn't. And they rarely won. High Energy rarely won.
But they were always fun.
Mm-hmm.
So check that out.
And check out our other great podcasts here on the network. At the end of the week, I'm on Daddy on Board. Over the weekend, Clayton's wife, Natalie, and I team up for The Trending Show. And when he's not here, Clayton is off on the FNF, as the kids call it on the streets. That's Fox and Friends. It's on the Fox News Network. That's a mouthful. FNF is on FNN.
Indeed. And then we'll be back here once again next week. And so get those websites in. Start working on those websites. We can't wait to see them. Again, we're going to pick a winner at the end of the month. But go to squarespace.com/grizzly. It's free to sign up. But you got to use that URL for it to count. Mm-hmm. And we will check them out. And, you know, tweet us. Let us know when you've got your site up. So it's Grizzly Bear Cafe. Just Grizzly Bear Cafe on Twitter. Drop the egg. Just Grizzly Bear Cafe on Twitter. Let us know when your site is up, and we'll go and check it out.
We will indeed.
All right, everyone. We'll see you again.
Goodbye, friends.